mystical writings. It is not specific to Rumi, and he is not the initiator or the inventor or the innovator of the issue. It is everywhere. And to the extent that you would even find it in Ghazali, who was, of course, a man not for love purely, but for reason as well. But as you know, for example, Muhammad Ghazali, who was the great scholar and the great thinker of the 5th century, he had a brother called Ahmad Ghazali, and who did not like scholarship and the rational sciences like his brother. Rather, he was for love, and he wrote a very important and influential book on love, and which no doubt was influential on Rumi himself. And so the idea of the love and taking one in order to leave the other has been always the story of all mysticism, including Islamic Sufism or Islamic mysticism. No wonder that we find it very conspicuous, very significant in Rumi's works as well. Looking back at the story of Rumi himself, also gives us some indication to this, because he was, as we saw, a theologian, a commentator on Quran, and a man of a very good orator, and he left all that behind because of the Shams's teachings, and he opted for mysticism. So all this actually tells us it was in the mind of Rumi about reason, intellect, and about love and the superiority of one over the other and the inferiority of one with regard to the other. And by and by, in the modern jargon, he developed a kind of epistemology in which love is on the top and is the main foundation and the main principle, and reason actually occupies a very small and base place. His hostility towards reasoning or reason or intellect must be interpreted correctly, otherwise one would be misled into wrong ideas about his epistemology. Though, as I said, Sufis and Rumi for that matter, they were not there in order to build an epistemological system, a philosophy or something. All mysticism is based on perplexity, as I said before, and perplexity is not suitable for building a system. It is apt and prone to contradictions, and Sufis were not shy. They're not shying away from contradictions, from perplexities, even from some sort of confusion, if you like. It was a madness of love that they prefer over the clarity of conceptualizations of philosophers and so on. So that was their way. And because of that, they did not build and they did not offer any philosophical, epistemological system whatsoever, consistent system. Nevertheless, we can find and we can elicit a kind of epistemology from their teachings and from their works. And here in Masnavi, of course, not in Divan, which is a fully mad love. In Masnavi, in which he was a sober teacher, we can discern a kind of epistemology which I am going to discuss now and here. In all epistemology, you have to have some ideas about some very lofty concepts, certainty, intellect, language, and the like. These are the capitals of the epistemologist. And as an epistemologist, you have to have your own ideas about this concept. Where you situate the language in the human understanding of the world, where you situate the certainty or supposition and so on, where you situate the science and the intellect, things like that. And in all these fields, you will find Rumi has got something to say, something very deep to say. I think we saw his ideas about language itself. Rumi always complains of language, of the shortcomings of language. He thinks that the ordinary conventional language is for the ordinary conventional experiences of man in this material world, and for the forms, as he puts it. But when it comes to the formlessness, to the formless world, there is no language, or at least our conventional, ordinary language is not there in order to describe the experiences of the formlessness. So the shortcomings of the language is so apparent to him, so visible to him, that he misses no opportunity in order to complain, in order to tell us that the language is not only a help, an aid to him, but a hindrance, an obstacle to him, in order to convey his message, in order to put forward his ideas, in order to conceptualize the experiences that he has. In one place, actually, he says that he wishes that the being itself has got its own language, in order to spare him from using his own language. And the language of the being, of course, is silence, according to Rumi. And that's why he uses silence as an eponym for himself. Most of his sonnets and odes actually are ended with the word silence, khamush in Persian, to the extent that people have thought, some of the scholars have thought that this is the second name, on an adopted name for Rumi, but that's not the case. He uses the word be silent, silence, and then, because he thinks that to say is not sufficient, and even it is, as I said, a veil on the idea, on the meaning, on the intention of the sayer, of the orator. Therefore, he thinks somewhere actually in Masnavi, he says, in silence, my sayings even would become clearer. So that he opts for silence and to stop saying, stop reciting, stop writing poems, and so on and so forth. So the word khamush or silence is very frequently and repeatedly used in is very frequently and repeatedly used in his writings, maybe more than any other poet, any other writer in Persian. So anyway, as far as the shortcomings of the language is concerned, as I said, he's very explicit on that, and this is his own actually experience. He didn't find language helpful at all. And here actually comes in the imagery of fish in his writings. He says that fish are always silent. And among the, of course, according to the old biology, I'm not sure of the modern biology, maybe they have got some sounds or voices, I'm not sure, but according to the old biology, birds have got songs, human beings have got song and everything, but the fish, they have no voice, no sound, nothing. And among many characteristics that fish have, this silence is so appealing to Rumi that he mentions this. Of course, he thinks that, and I think I mentioned it last time, that in the case of fish, there are many characteristics, especially that they have got no belonging, nothing. Their house is water, their food is water, their drink is water, their clothing is water, everything is water. And on top of all this, they are silent. They do not say anything. And they are the best example of a Sufi, of a mystic, of a contemplative who is immersed in the ocean of the grace of God. Really, that is what he means. And in addition to that, also fish is, as you know, a symbol of Christ, of course. I mean, in Christianity and also in Islam. Therefore, when he uses the symbol of fish, also he has got a hidden allusion to the idea of the Jesus, the person of Jesus and Christ. And as you know, Rumi personally was in love with Jesus because he thought that he was a dervish. He was a Sufi himself, because he didn't have anything, he didn't possess anything, he had no belonging, nothing. He was not a man of this world. He was a man, or perhaps a superman or something, an angel, belonging to some other world. And because of this, he announced a special respect to Jesus. And because of this, of course, as I said, he used the symbol of fish as well in his writings. So when you choose and use the symbolism of fish, that tells you a lot about many things, including especially about the language. Since, as I said, fish is mute, is tongueless, if you like, and doesn't speak. And that is more meaningful than speaking, than the speech. And it tells you a lot about the secrets of the universe. Because this is the teaching of Rumi and all other mystics, that if you know the secrets, you have to keep silent. Otherwise, you will lose your head. But this does not mean physically you will lose your head, but this means that you will be rejected by the divine authority or something. So you have to keep secret, and you have to bury, so to speak, your language, your tongue, as if you are tongueless, you are speechless. You have to train yourself in order to keep secrets to yourself and do not disclose it to the people who are not appropriate for it, who are not the people of mysteries and the secrets of the being, universe, of God, and so on and so forth. So he has got his theory about language, no doubt about it, and the shortcomings and the small and very limited capacity of language in order to accommodate the divine, the religious, the supreme experiences of the mystics, of the contemplatives, and therefore for them it's better to keep silent rather than to speak out their mysteries. And even sometimes, and this is very curious of him, he says, I say something in order some other things. That is his policy, that he adopts very intentionally, very consciously. در خاموشی گفته ما از هر شود که ز من آن میل افزونتر شود. He said, if I keep silent all the time, then eventually and inevitably I have to say something, and sometimes some of the mysteries will push themselves out. Therefore I deliberately, intentionally say something in order to hide some other precious things. Like a shopper who actually brings you the base commodity in order to hide, you see, the better commodities out there for the special customers. So exactly that is what Rumi did and the policy that he adopted. Actually what we see in his book and his writing, according to him himself, is for the common people. There are no mysteries in his poets. And so we do not know actually he kept the secrets and the mysteries for whom and to whom he disclosed. So for all its sacredness and the high level of the content and the materials in it, nevertheless, according to Rumi himself, he has said all this to us in order to conceal some other better things to himself and not to be forced to disclose them, I mean unintentionally and unconsciously to others. So this is his theory about language. As to certainty, I discussed it very briefly last time, that for him there will be no certainty in the field of science or philosophy or theology or whatever. All are suppositions. Because when there is a distance between the knower and the known, there is always a distance, and this distance never lets you reach certainty. Because you look at things from distance. Of course, we are knowers. We are people who have got mind, who have got this sensory apparatus and things like that. And these are our instruments in order to discover the world and in order to experience the facts and so on and so forth. But there will be always a distance between us and the fact and the objective reality. Okay? And this actually prevents us from attaining certainty or obtaining certainty. So what we say always is a kind of supposition. Sometimes more likely, sometimes less likely, but nevertheless it is a kind of supposition, guess, theories, and so on and so forth. And that's why actually he doesn't like philosophy, and I will discuss it more fully later on. Because philosophy, after all, is a kind of a system of knowledge which is based on suppositions according to him, not on certainties. Though philosophers are proud of themselves that their business or their system or their school is all certainties. But according to Rumi, well, they are just bluffing, and there is no certainty in what they say. No, but when it comes to love, since there is a unity between the lover and the beloved, okay, this unity actually makes you certain and paves the way for certainty. Where there is a unity, there is certainty. When there is a duality, a distance between the knower and the known, there's always a supposition, a guess, and a darkness, a cloudiness, if you like, around the object or the subject that you are trying to know and to understand. All understanding is like this. Actually, according to philosophy, modern and ancient, in order to be objective, you have to be disunited, you have to keep your distance from it. This is one of the criteria of objectivity. To be one and the same with the object of the knowledge, there will be no knowledge at all. So you have to be, different from the object of knowledge and look at it from a distance in order to overcome it, to comprehend it, so to speak, and to understand it objectively, fully, and impartially. This is one of the requirements and one of the criteria of the objectivity in all science, philosophy, theology, and so on. And in the case of theology, you know, the disaster now happens here. In the case of the theology, according to Rumi, you have to be different and distant from God in order to understand him and know him objectively. The requirement of objectivity in science may not be as disastrous as it is in theology. In theology, the requirement tells you and demands you to be different, to be distant, and to keep this distance quite consciously from God in order to know him objectively. But according to Rumi, this is a false certainty, a false objectivity, and a false knowledge. This is all suppositions. Here the lovers can fare much better than philosophers, because lovers actually are united with the object of their love. And in the case of knowing God and loving him, it is very clear that through loving him and nearer to him, and in one and the same with him, that gives you ample opportunity in order to know him directly, objectively, and with certainty, with absolute certainty, in the formlessness that God has got. But of course, that awareness and that knowledge is inconceptualizable. And there you will find the shortcomings and the limitations of the language better than anywhere else. You will find that you cannot describe it. It is absolutely ineffable. And for that matter, first of all, you will leave the language of philosophers, because that clarity and that consistency that philosophy requires never can be actually adopted in the case of the experiences that a mystic has got, a lover has got, actually. And then you have to choose poetry rather than prose in order to express yourself, because in poetry you have got place in order to use figurative language, because philosophy, science, they are not allowed to use figurative language. You are not allowed in chemistry to use metaphor, figurative language, allegories, things like that. But in the case of poetry, this is actually the whole language. And that gives, that's why most of the contemplatives, if not all of them, they have used a poetic language. They haven't used just the simple language of philosophers or whatever. always a poetic language, and this is also the language of all religions. And according to some philosophers, religion is a higher poetry, and that is very true, because in the case of higher experiences, you have to use a higher language, and that higher language can be found only in poetry and in poetical expressions, where symbolism and figurative language is predominant. So that's why you see, for example, in the case of Rumi himself, as I said to you, he has got a book also, which is not a book written by him himself. It's a book, a collection of his speeches. It is very dull. It is very dull. It is not as impressive as poetry. And his poetry is much, much more impressive because it is poetry. Because there actually Rumi can use this very important equipment, instrument of figurative and language. And that's why it is so influential. And this, to some extent, give you the power in order to relate the higher experience of a mystic, of a lover, in whose union with the beloved he has discovered things that the intellect cannot discover and cannot conceptualize. Okay, so the shortcoming of the language actually is a reflection of the shortcoming of intellect. So we come now to the business of the intellect, of reason, because after all, language is the external intellect, and intellect is the internal language, if you like. The internal language to ourselves is our intellect, our reason, but when we exteriorize it, when we make it, you see, effable, we would like to convey it to others, our intellect actually shows itself in the garb and in the shape of our language. The more intellectual you are, the better language you can use. The finer language, the less inconsistent language you will use. So that is a sign of your intellectuality and the quality of your intellect and or your reasoning. So as I said, the language is, so to speak, the exterior intellect, and the intellect is the interior language, if you like. Now the shortcomings of the language means the shortcomings of the intellect. So any theory about language will automatically translate into a theory about the intellect. Any theory about the language, and that was indeed the policy of the logical positivists in the modern time. You see, their program was the continuation of the Kantian program. In the Kant, you will see, he discusses the shortcomings or the limitations or the characteristics of the intellect, of the reason, of human understanding, and so on and so forth. But in the modern time, in the case of the positivists and the logical positivists, you see their main concern is with the language rather than the intellect itself, because the language is the manifestation, if you like, of the intellect. And in order to catch the intellect, the handiest thing to put your hand on is the language. Therefore, they actually chose and selected the language in order to discuss it and in order to deal with it, to disclose the shortcomings of the intellect, and so on and so forth. Now you will see that in Rumi as well, the thing goes exactly the same way. He begins with discussing language and telling us that the language is not enough, is not sufficient for describing the higher experiences of man and of the contemplative, and then he goes on and moves on to discuss the reason or the intellect. I am not sure which word I use, reason or intellect. From one point of view, of course, reason is maybe better, because the idea of the word reason coming from ratio in Latin means at the same time reason and rationing, you know, rationing, dividing the food, and this is at the root of the word reason, means something as if had been divided among people. Ration, the rational people does not have the universal intellect. It is partial reason that they have got. So there has been a process of rationing before people become rational. So, and this is very, very close to what Rumi intends, actually. That we have got partial reason, we do not have universal reason, we do not have a perfect reason, a complete reason. It's only part of the universal reason that everybody of us has got and possess. So, and that was actually the idea in Old Greek, that they differentiated between the intellect and the reason. The reason is the partial reason, and the intellect somehow resembles the universal reason or the perfect reason. But anyway, in Rumi, of course, you sometimes use the Arabic word aql, which you find it in all Arabic literature and Quran as well, and sometimes uses the Persian word of aql, which exactly means the same thing. But of course, the connotation in Arabic, which I should mention, is this, that aql in Arabic originally and mainly means to prevent. Okay. Therefore, aql in Arabic mainly means the practical reason rather than theoretical reason. This is something that one has to be very careful when reads Quran, the religious literature. Because there in Quran we find in many places and many times that tell us and recommend us to use our reason, our aql. And this has been sometimes misinterpreted by commentators. They thought that aql here means reason in the Greek sense of the word, or intellect in the Greek sense of the word, whereas it does not. It is practical reason. And practical reason is very keen to a kind of morality, ethicality, taqwa, piety, things like that. So that is the meaning of the aql in the original sense of it. Nowadays, of course, in Arabic literature and everywhere, aql is, of course, used both in both cases, practical as well as theoretical reason. But Khirad in Persian, of course, there is no such a distinction in the meaning of the word. But in the case of Rumi, anyway, reason, when compared with love, of course, scores much less than love itself. You remember that I mentioned that according to him, cleverness is for Iblis, for the Satan, and love is for human beings. Human beings' main property is love, and Satan's main property is cleverness. He was clever, according to Rumi, because he was a good calculator. And that is the main function of reason, calculation, and being a good merchant. Okay, he was a good calculator. When God actually ordered him to prostrate to Adam, he said, "I am better than Adam. I am made from fire, and he is made from clay, and therefore I am better. Therefore, he should prostrate to me rather than me to him." And that was a calculation which showed his cleverness. But this is satanic cleverness. It is not a divine cleverness. And that's what makes cleverness, in his case, lower than love. Donadun funik bakhto mahramas. A fortunate man will know zirakiz iblis o ishq az adam is iblis. Love is from Adam and for Adam, a property and a possession of Adam. So when it comes to cleverness, intellect, Rumi whatsoever, to tell us that this is much weightier than the other and scores much better than the other, is more precious than the other. And now I am going to discuss this and to see why reason is like this. By reason, Rumi means the whole and everything of human beings. Do not bother yourself with the modern theories about reason and understand these things, because all these are lumped together in Rumi's and indeed in the old theory of mind. So mind you, one thing which is very interesting to me, in the past, as you know, there was a debate about the scholars, about the thinkers, which of two was the main source of understanding, heart or, and as you know, Aristotelian theory was which one was the apparatus of understanding the heart, according to Aristotle and his school. Actually, mind was there in order to cool the blood. So that was the cooling the blood, that was the main function of the brain. But for the understanding, of course, it was heart. Curiously enough, you will find in Rumi that he uses the brain as the organ of understanding, rather than heart, you see. And this is very significant. Of course, there was a debate in the past. I'm not saying that he entered a new theory, but the reasons behind it is not clear to me, why Rumi opted for the brain as the organ of understanding, or as the residence of mind, if you like, rather than heart. In many places he says, "Maqzaman za'aql hushkuhis," my brain is empty of intellect and so on. So he is very explicit on that. Now let us go on and see why, in Rumi's case, what is his epistemology anyway? I mean, let us not use the word looking with contempt or whatever, which are very loaded terminology. What is his epistemology, i.e. what is his ideas about reason? I have chosen for you actually three stories here. The story of elephant, and the story of the Greek and the Chinese, and there is a third story which you do not have it in the handouts. Everybody has got the handouts now. And so the story of the elephant is of course a very well-known story, and the origin is Indian, as you know. And of course, all scholars so tell us. And you can find it, of course, in Ghazali, in Ihya ul-Ulum, in the revivification of the sciences. And no doubt the source of Rumi here is Ghazali, because he has taken so many things, ideas and stories from Ghazali, especially from his magnum opus, Ihya ul-Ulum, including this particular story. And this particular story is very apt for telling us the story of the intellect and the shortcomings of the sense, and how our understanding is piecemeal, can never be perfect. And in order to be perfect, we have to use another organ or another source, another apparatus, whatever, which he thinks that must be either the revelation or love. But as far as we are entangled or entrapped by our senses, by our system or organs of understanding, we never comprehend the thing comprehensively. It's always partial understanding of things. The story of the elephant runs as follows. You have got the handout, and I would request one of our friends here to read us. Martin, would you read us?
Elephant in the dark. Some Hindus have an elephant to show. No one here has ever seen an elephant. They bring it at night to a dark room. One by one, we go in the dark and come out, seeing how we experience the animal. One of us happens to touch the trunk, a water pipe kind of creature. Another the ear, very strong, always moving back and forth to stand on. Another the leg. I find it still with a column on a temple. Another touches the curved back, a leathery throat. Another, the cleverest, feels the tusk, a rounded sword made of porcelain, is proud of its description. Each of us touches one place and understands the whole in that way. The palm and the fingers, feeling in the dark, are how the senses explore the reality of the elephant. If each of us held a candle there, if we went in together, we could see it.
Okay, I mean, the message is quite clear, and you won't miss it. I mean, the elephant is a very big animal, of course, and that is a symbol of the universe, or of the facts there, anyway. Natural and supernatural, whatever is there, is like a very big elephant with many organs and different parts, okay? Now, it is in the dark. And this darkness is the darkness of the senses, is the darkness of the understanding, is the darkness of our eyes, if you like, to see it and to feel it and to comprehend it. So in darkness we approach the elephant. Okay. Since our eyes do not function in the darkness, so we use our hand in order to sense and feel the elephant. Our hand is a simple senses, whatever it is, eyes, ears, even our mind, brain, or whatever. So we can only take part of it, because the elephant is so big, we cannot actually cover all of it. We can only touch part of it. Now, people who try to understand and to know the world. So now we go out of the darkness and we discuss among ourselves what we have found. It is exactly like a seminar in which scientists are there and they are discussing their findings, okay? Their scholarship, and they are very proud that they have found something at last. And everybody claims that he has touched upon the whole reality. He has found and he has covered the whole reality. So he says that the human beings, for example, the definition of human being is this, and the other one says that it is that and this and that. But none of them is quite aware that he has only touched part of the reality rather than the whole of the reality. So all of our understanding are partial in both senses of the word. Partial in the sense that it is not comprehensive, it is not complete. Partial in the sense that it is not impartial. You see, because it comes from us, it depends which organ and where and when we use in order to understand and to capture the reality. So the big elephant is the big universe, universe of facts, universe of what is there, material, immaterial, natural, supernatural, whatever it is. We are the poor visitors in the darkness of the elephant, trying to touch something and to catch something. But of a lot will be very, very small. This is the story of the intellect. This is the story of the intellect. Now, of course, I mean, the translation is incomplete here. It is also partial, I would say. So Rumi actually goes on to tell us something about religion, about God, about everything. Actually, he does not leave us at that. So he draws a lot of conclusions from the story. If Rumi were an epistemologist, he would make a lot of this story, but since he was a mystic, just wanted to tell us that in order to understand things, we need something else. We cannot rely wholly and solely on our intellect. That is his main mission here. And that is what he wants to convey us very clearly and very successfully, actually. But where he had he been an epistemologist, of course, this story has got a lot of lessons to draw from and to understand and to convey, actually. But of course, as I said, these people did not care about this. Of course, actually, Rumi, he was really very careful not to philosophize about what he is saying. And he just wanted to tell us very briefly and points to the fact very directly, no more than that. So what he says then at the end of the story, you will see here that if each of us held a candle there, see, the idea of the candle comes in. I.e., if we visited the elephant not in the darkness, but when it was light enough to see it. If every one of us had a candle there, and if we went in together, of course, this bit is the translator's. It is not in Rumi, actually. And this is under the influence of the modern epistemology, that if we were in, as you know, in modern epistemology, they always insist that science is a collective endeavor. It is not an individual business or something. And this is what he says, but I assure you that this bit is not in Rumi. But it's harmless, as long as you know that it is not his. Okay? So, if each of us held a candle there, and I tell you and reaffirm the point that all mysticism is individualistic. There is no, I mean, slightest what is a concern about collectivity? Nothing of that kind. Each of us confront God individually. Each of us confront reality individually. Each of us confront ourselves individually. There is a verse in Quran. This I tell you to say that how far the translator has been from the the depth of the worldview of mysticism. The gentleman Coleman Barks, we respect him a lot, but nevertheless we have to criticize him. This translation has been made under the modern, you see, worldview. And because of that, collectivity is always praised. I am not saying that collectivity is bad, but what I'm saying is this, that in mysticism there is no place for collectivity. Individuality reigns supreme, is everything. There is a verse in Quran actually which our mystics have taken it as their motto. In Quran you will see in the chapter of Mary, remember, that لَقَدْ جِئْتُمُونَا فُرَادًا, you come to us, this is about, of course, about the Day of Judgment, you come to us individually, not collectively. So that is in the chapter of Mary. لَقَدْ جِئْتُمُونَا فُرَادًا كَمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ أَوَّلَ مَرَّةً, we gave birth to you, we created you individually, and you will come back to us individually again. So everybody comes to God on the basis of his own deeds, on his own characteristic, and there is all connections, so to speak, are cut off from others. If you are the son of this, the daughter of that, the uncle of this, the friend of this and that, all these connections are cut off. You are absolutely individual, isolated, in order to face your God. Now, this is about the Day of Judgment, but according to the contemplatives, every day is the Day of Judgment. Every day is the Day of Judgment. You should not sit and wait for the Day of Judgment. That is for the ordinary people. They think that this life is a different from the next life, and so God will come, on some fine day in order to grab us and so on and so forth. That is not the case. For a contemplative, these two lives are the same. God is everywhere, ever present, and we are confronting and facing him every day, encountering him every day. We are it as his presence, and he is judging us every day and every moment. Individually, we are at his presence every moment, and every day is the Day of Judgment, and God is ever present. That is the case. Therefore, to understand the world, to capture the reality, to face God, to know him, to love him, all is individualistic. And mind you, even in the modern epistemology, love cannot be a collective thing. We cannot collectively, love something. Love is in depth, absolutely individual. You cannot rely on somebody, you cannot share your life with somebody else. Nothing of that kind. This is exactly like faith. Faith also is an individual thing. And I remember that I mentioned this the last session, and I am very glad to repeat it, to say that religion is collective, but faith is individual. Okay. Faith is a love work, and love is a faith work, and these two are very similar to each other, and all are individualistic and personal, if you like. So this bit, which is added by the respectable, dear translator, nevertheless we have to be on our guard, which is not Rumi's anyway. In each of us, if each of us held a candle there, we could see it. Okay. Now what is this candle? No doubt that it is something which has to be added to the intellect in order for the intellect to become powerful, to cover and to comprehend the reality. That candle either is the revelation, according to Rumi, or love, which leads to revelation. So this revelation is a superior sense, according to Rumi. And Rumi is not shy to tell us that contemplatives actually receive revelations from God. They are no prophets, of course, but they receive revelations. And this revelation is something which does not come through our sensory organs, but that comes to us from an undescribable channel. This is actually what Rumi himself says. Bichun means something which we cannot describe its qualities. And it is undescribable, nevertheless it exists. And we receive the revelation. So we need a super sense, if you like, in order to understand and to comprehend the and to overcome the shortcomings of the intellect, okay, and to reach certainty, and to reach the unity with the object of our knowledge. All these are means the candle. Now, let us, in order to have an idea of where the candle comes from, so let us read the second story about the Chinese and the Greek. This story about the Chinese and the Greek art, this also, you would find it in Ghazali as well. And again, no doubt, Rumi has taken it from him. And forget about the Chinese and the Greek and these contingencies and things, and just concentrate on the content and the meaning of the story. So we need somebody, a Chinese or a Greek, yeah, to read us, please. Yeah.
Chinese and the Greeks were arguing